Vietnam and Korean War veteran John Burge joined Chicago PD in 1970, made detective in 1972, and eventually detective commander of Area 2 and later Area 3. During his career, heinous acts of brutality and torture were carried out by him or at his direction, fixing cases with coerced confessions and false witness statements alike. He and his brethren were known as the Midnight Crew. Before his termination in disgrace in 1993 and his eventual federal prison sentence, Burge and his crew beat and electrocuted 13-year-old Marcus Wiggins to extract a confession to the 1991 murder of Alfredo Hernandez. Fortunately, a courageous witness named Sean Tyler came forward and ensured that the attempted frame job failed. Marcus's mother, Carolyn, sued and eventually settled for $95,000. However, the Midnight Crew didn't like being exposed. In 1994, they tried to frame Marcus again, along with Sean Tyler, for the murder of Rodney Collins. But Marcus was at school in Wisconsin, so his alibi was rock solid. Sean Tyler was not as lucky, and he's currently serving 58 years. Then, on February 27, 1998, Theopolis Teague was found undressed and shot. I won't bore you with the completely made-up story about a fender bender from witnesses who have since recanted, one of whom was shot in the mouth the morning he was set to deliver an affidavit. Marcus Wiggins was paroled after 23 years in prison and has not yet been exonerated. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me, of course. I'm your host. And today, we're going to be telling the story with Marcus Wiggins of Marcus Wiggins. Marcus was framed three times by the same cops. Let me just roll that back again. Three times by the same cops. He was physically tortured in a way that, you know, you would see and locked up abroad in some third world country. But it happened right in Chicago. With us today, we have his legal team, and that consists of Justin Bonus, who is Marcus's pro bono appellate counsel. So, Justin, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you, Jason.
And then a guy with his own amazing story, but we're going to tell it in a different episode. But today we have Jared Adams. Jared was wrongfully convicted himself, sentenced almost three decades in prison, and basically became a lawyer in prison, got himself out, passed the bar, worked at the Innocence Project for a couple years as an attorney, is now in private practice. I'm super happy to have you on here, this time as an attorney representing an innocent man.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Great to have you here. And of course, Marcus Wiggins, as I always say, I'm happy you're here, but I'm sorry you're here because of the reason why you're here. But anyway, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
I appreciate you, man.
So let's get right into it, because this story, it's a Chicago story. And of course, Chicago has a miserable history of law enforcement having tortured hundreds of black men, specifically black men, in a literal torture chamber. It was an offsite warehouse. And I know it sounds insane, but it's all true. It's all been documented. And hundreds of innocent men went to jail. But also, cops went to jail as a result of their horrendous illegal activities and their disgusting practice of torturing confessions and false witness statements out of people. And of course, that group of cops was known as the infamous Midnight Crew of Chicago Police Detective Commander John Burge. Now, Laura Nyreiter and Steve Drizin covered them on our show, Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions. So to hear more about them, you can find that right on our feed here. But today, we're here to talk about Marcus's cases specifically. So Marcus, take us back to before all of this happened. What was your life like growing up?
Young, in school, wanted to be a firefighter, a Secret Service agent, you know, just being a kid. Come home from school, do my homework, look at cartoons, you know, just a normal kid life.
A normal kid life. But this nightmare began when you were just 13 years old.
So Marcus gets picked up in 91 for a homicide along with several other people. And he's beaten with a flashlight over the head, electrocuted, taken in the precinct, tortured some more along with other people. And from my understanding is that people actually heard screams in the police station. And all the while that this was going on, there was a witness that could exonerate Marcus, that did exonerate Marcus, a guy by the name of Sean Tyler. And the police were so on Deshaun Tyler that a judge issued a protective order for Sean Tyler, that the police were not allowed to talk to Sean Tyler. And this case went on for about 4 or 5 years before the case was dismissed in 1996. In 1993, Marcus's mother filed a civil rights complaint alleging the torture by John Burge, and Fred Bunkey was a sergeant, Kenneth Boudreaux, James O'Brien. These were all officers that were involved with Marcus's alleged statement that they took after they beat him until he gave the statement.
I'm just shocked that a person, as a citizen of this country, was electric shocked. Something that this guy learned, I think I read somewhere, at Vietnam.
In Korea, yeah.
And came over here and used that tactics. And it's not an outrage.
Yeah.
That's like mind-blowing to me. Like the state's attorney's office and everybody that who was involved didn't say, enough is enough, man. We can't allow this to happen to our citizens.
I mean, I imagine with what you went through, you would have confessed to killing Abraham Lincoln. Am I right?
Man, you know, people going to that type of torture, you know what I'm saying, anything just to get from under that pressure and that pain
of course
that you're going through.
Especially at 13 years old.
I mean, 13. And then the thing about it, too, you know, when you think about Burge, Jason, you don't get decorated in Korean wars and Vietnam wars if you don't get trauma. You understand what I'm saying? So this is a guy who was given such power, and it may have been broken with Marcus's case, but the PD's office had notes between each other for years before Marcus, and they were all saying, hey, these guys, it's like they're reading off a template. You know, it's like all of their confessions are signed and written the same. And, you know, and it's like, you know, Marcus said, somebody should have stepped up and said, stop. Let's not move forward until we find out if all 150 of these black men who signed confessions, and I'm just throwing out a number, but you could just scratch out a name. And you could put Marcus's or anyone else's confession, Sean Tyler and all of them, and you would see the same hallmarks. There's no way judges weren't tipped that something was wrong with that.
Right. Every confession was the same, and every one of the victims would basically describe the same treatment.
That lawsuit that Marcus's mom spearheaded, it really unearthed exactly how they were doing what they were doing, right? Because it's one thing for people to just say, hey, they beating me, they kicking me. They found out in several different other circumstances that they were doing the same type of tactics. They were smacking people with phone books so it wouldn't leave a mark. They would twist your genitals so no one could be seen in court with bruises on them. So when Marcus went through with the lawsuit, it settled for $95,000 and made Marcus a target from that point on.
This was the Alfredo Hernandez murder, right? And ultimately, they couldn't pin that on you. Now we get to the second framing, right, which is the murder of Rodney Collins.
Correct.
Right? And so they do no investigation whatsoever, right?
No. Which homicide didn't they do any investigation on? They did no investigation on all of them. Yeah. They rely on terrible, wholly unreliable witnesses. I mean, Marcus's name and Rodney Collins gets thrown in there, and they list him as a gang member in the Alfredo Hernandez, the different gang member in Rodney Collins, and then I think a different gang member in Theopolis Teague, which we haven't gotten to yet, which is 1998.
So we did a little research, Marcus, on you, because I went back thinking, well, why would he be targeted by the cops in this way in the first place? And all I could find about your background is that you were described as sweet, caring, good-hearted, funny, like people had nothing but good things to say about young Marcus. And I mean, were you ever in a gang or anything like that?
No.
I already knew the answer to that question because I researched it. And the idea that this was really good versus evil, like literally good versus evil. I mean, we're talking about cops that were ultimately convicted of heinous acts of violence, torture, psychological abuse, electrocuting, mock executions.
Right. The same detectives that arrested and tortured Marcus and knew about Sean Tyler as an exculpatory witness, then go after Sean Tyler for the Rodney Collins murder. He's another Burge victim. So is his brother. There was several others that were convicted in this murder. And Sean, I think he was beaten until he vomited blood. Sean Tyler ends up getting 58 years in prison, and his post-conviction motion is pending, and he's, you know, claiming he's innocent. So Marcus was a target of that investigation as well from these same officers Marcus was eliminated as a suspect because he was in school in Wisconsin because he left the state, okay, because he was terrified, all right, as he still is. And I think if Marcus had been in the city of Chicago for the Rodney Collins murder,
he would have gone down for it.
He would have been, yeah, he would have been convicted.
Okay, so now we get to the crux of the situation. Why Marcus spent 23 years wrongfully incarcerated. The murder of Theophilus Teague on February 27th, 1998. This is the story of the crime that the police and state's attorney's office used to convict Marcus. But I believe we can all see a pattern forming here that leans towards this being a total fabrication from Burge and his flunkies. So, okay, allegedly Theophilus Teague was driving down 51st Street in Chicago with Cedric Farley and Terrence Tyler, Sean Tyler's fucking brother, by the way, okay? And allegedly now, the maroon car in front of Theophilus Teague's car backs up into them with enough force to push them in the car backward. Then Teague allegedly drove to the 5200 block of South Marshfield Avenue, parked his car, and got out to assess the damage. At which point, supposedly, the driver of the maroon car, allegedly Marcus Wiggins, stepped up to Teague and said, "What's up now?" Teague and the others allegedly ran while Marcus allegedly opened fire, killing Teague. Now, neighbors heard 13 shots that supposedly came from a 9mm semi-automatic. Neither were shell casings found or collected at the scene, by the way, nor were bullets recovered from Teague's body. So police maintained that the shooting was gang-related, despite what we already covered, which was that Marcus was never in any gangs. Again, the state's word here is wholly and totally unreliable. Now, according to Cedric Farley, a statement and testimony that he later recanted, he ran over to Teague, who allegedly told him that a guy named Stutter shot him. And Stutter was Marcus's nickname.
Yeah, Marcus, please clarify about calling you Stutter and stuff like that, like where it came from.
It came from after the torture. Like, my friends, my cousin, them, you know, when I talk, I stutter.
Right.
So it gave me that name because I stutter after the torture.
So that's important, Jason, because they put that shit in the witness's mouth, man. Mm. That's intimate knowledge from somebody that you know sued you and warned.
Wow. The Pacers Foundation is a proud supporter of this episode of Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom and of the Last Mile Organization, which provides business and tech training to help incarcerated individuals successfully and permanently re-enter the workforce. The Pacers Foundation is committed to improving the lives of Hoosiers across Indiana, supporting organizations that are dedicated primarily to helping young people and students. For more information on the work of the Pacers Foundation or the Last Mile program, please visit pacersfoundation.org or thelastmile.org. This episode is underwritten by Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison, a leading international law firm. Paul Weiss has long had an unwavering commitment to providing impactful pro bono legal assistance to the most vulnerable members of our society and in support of the public interest, including extensive work in the criminal justice area. It's worth noting that a witness to the alleged fender bender, remember that part of the story, reported that the car Marcus was allegedly driving was maroon or burgundy, but we know that he never owned a maroon or burgundy car. He owned a black car. And the mechanic bravely also reported that when Marcus brought his black car, again, black, the color was black, to the shop, it had no damage to the rear bumper. So, and the police towed it. So the police knew that that didn't match up.
The mechanic, that information only comes out 3 years after his conviction.
Yeah.
So it's documented that that car was in the shop. And get this, the police take the car out of the shop, destroy it right away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, now here's another crazy thing about this case. The victim, Theophilus Teague, his body was discovered clothed only in a t-shirt and boxers in the dead of Chicago winter.
So during this time in this era, when people were robbed, they would make them undress almost, right? So that was a big detail. It was glossed over. right? Mm-hmm. So it's more likely than not how the body was found, like you said, with the T-shirt, with the boxers, that he was robbed, then shot and killed. And it had nothing to do with the scenario that they made up to get their target, Marcus.
Or he was dropped there.
That as well. Those are the options. But the option of back into the car, I went to go check the damage, I was shot and ran away, it's nonsense and it's never been credible.
So we now have the car he didn't own, the gun he never owned, the gang that he was never in, because they said this was a gang-related shooting, which again would point away from Marcus.
Right.
Everyone knew he was never in a gang. In fact, he used to be tormented by gang members because he wasn't in a gang.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, Marcus is charged with murder. Lana Johnson, this is his attorney through the initial trial, and the state utilized, that's a word is chosen carefully, three witnesses, Cedric Farley, R.L. Mahan, and Kelly Stokes, to testify against Marcus.
And he fully recanted. He was interviewed by Kenneth Boudreaux, yeah, who was a person that Marcus sued in 1993.
And let's just say Kenneth Boudreaux was a hands-on interviewer.
Totally hands-on. People want to make Chicago only look like confessions are what these guys were obtaining through torture. They were getting everything through torture. All the witnesses in this case were the type of guys that you want to flip. And how do you flip them?
Force. It was their go-to move. Was it.
Right. Well, they weren't doing any investigating, so I guess what else you got, right?
Yeah.
They do no canvas in this case. What police do when they find a body in the neighborhood, what do? They go door to door to talk to people. What independent witnesses do we have? They don't do that. No shell casings, no door to door. You arrest a guy 3 hours later, and Jason, 3 hours after the crime in the 90s, and even till today,
right?
It is standard to do gunshot residue testing on clothing, hands. The powder is going to stay on you.
Right.
They don't do any of this because they don't want the physical evidence to show the unreliability of their witnesses. And I mean, unreliability to me is actually a kind word in this case. Okay?
Very kind.
It's kind. The lies, the fabrication.
Right.
And all the witnesses say when they're in the police station, they're talking about Marcus Wiggins.
They were aggressively disinterested in who actually committed this crime, which of course is just more damage to
the public safety issue.
Right, of course.
You know, for folks like Marcus, you know, even like myself back then, you can't afford a fucking attorney, man. Like, you can't even, like, somebody like Justin back then with those facts, well, fucking hammer him, man. The guy's found damn near naked in the wintertime. If he was running, when did he have time to take his clothes off?
How about you investigate?
Yeah.
If they would have called the cops in this case in front of a Chicago jury, the jury would have heard that these cops were sued by this kid 5 years prior. And they tried to frame him in 94. Like, this all would have come out. And I hate to slam them because they cross-examine one of the witnesses. One of the witnesses recants, but then they don't call their own investigator. But they get out of the witness that the witness recanted, a 13-year-old. This guy, R.L. Mahan, who was named as the killer by one of our witnesses presently, recants. You know, he actually says Marcus doesn't do it. I mean, you know, and then he gets back and he recants on his recantation.
All three of them later recanted their testimonies, right?
Yeah.
Two of them, Farley and Stokes, signed affidavits admitting that their testimonies were false. That's very brave, right, considering what they had been through.
Yeah.
When you say, well, what happened to the third witness? I'm glad you asked. The third witness was fatally shot in the mouth on the day that he planned to sign a similar document. That's got to give everybody the fucking chills. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was shot in the mouth on the day he was going to sign a similar document.
What a coincidence.
Jesus Christ. That's a mafia
shit. And he recanted to three different people. He recanted on the witness stand at trial. He recanted to Marcus's appellate attorney. And then he recanted to another woman, Tracy Ross, who gave a sworn affidavit as well. So R.L. Mahan, he recanted three separate times before he was killed.
And if that wasn't enough, people are probably pulling their hair out sitting at home listening to this or in their car. Melinda Chavers also reported what she knew about the case in a signed affidavit, that she was sitting on her porch when Teague, a member of the Blackstones, Teague was the victim, came up to her and said that he saw a murder by other Blackstone members and that they were going to come after him and kill him. So this is powerful, right? Because those witnesses were never called to the stand either. And we don't know if that's because of threats from detectives or more torture or just ineffective assistance. But that's certainly, since Marcus was never a member of the Blackstones, you know, or any of these gangs, that certainly would have also been exculpatory. So there were all these different witnesses who could have refuted the state's phony narrative, the whole thing about the bumper. There were the witnesses that could have placed you at your girlfriend's house, multiple witnesses. Why did your attorney not call them? And did you have conversations with your attorney about it at that time?
Man, oh man.
I had a conversation with her, but she was under the impression that she didn't need to call witness because R.M. Mayhem had changed his statement and that was going to be the winning ticket.
You know, listen.
All too familiar.
And and it's the same thing that I went through. Where it is, where a lawyer court appointed, oh, this is a slam dunk. You don't have to worry about that. I've never heard of a patient saying, oh, man, look, that's okay. You gave me half the antibiotics. You can keep the rest. I think this half will probably work. It doesn't make any sense.
Right, doc, just take half of my appendix out. I think that'll work.
Makes no sense.
But, you know, there was no chance. This was a show trial because Marcus was never going to get a fair ruling as long as the presiding judge was Dennis Dernback, because mm-hmm. Dernback was known at the time as being a part of Burge's go-to team when he had worked in the state's attorney's office. And he had a history of accepting confessions despite knowing that they were coerced and given under torture.
Mm-hmm.
Sickening.
Dernback, he allowed the state to have their way. And then my attorney, Lana Johnson, couldn't do this, couldn't do that. He gave his state a lot of leeway. Later, when I found out who Dernback was, I ain't stand a chance anyway.
So September 19th, 1999, Marcus, I mean, you had a lot of bad days in your life leading up to this, but
man,
can you take us back to that miserable day when you were found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to 46 years in prison? What was that moment like?
I couldn't believe it. I went numb, you know, guilty. And then he gave me 46 years, you know. Prison is what? Like the soldiers, when they leave from overseas and come back home, they have post-trauma stress. I have that, you know, so because of the torture. The jails, the penitentiaries, it's not a place nobody want to be. You have to constantly be on guard. You have to defend yourself. The officers, you know, they come in with a baggage on top of everything else that's going on in our jails. So it's a nightmare, man. You know what I'm saying? Don't nobody want to live a nightmare. I know I don't want to live a nightmare no more.
In 2002, Marcus filed a pro se motion with detailing about the destruction of the car, detailing that the car was in the shop. You know, it's amazing. The car's in the shop, car gets destroyed by the police. The piece of evidence that they needed to prove their case that there was a car accident, gone, right? Marcus's alibis, all detailed in his pro se motion in 2002. It was a very good motion. It should have had a hearing. It was summarily denied. Again, we go back to Dennis Dernback, the guy who presides over his trial, the guy who has this intimate relationship with these cops, is the guy that hears the post-conviction motion. And then for years, Marcus went really without a lawyer. And again, he battled, and Northwestern got involved because they saw Marcus's case, and they ended up doing a documentary. Jane Riley took over his case, and God bless her.
God bless her.
God bless her. But she passed away, and so Marcus gets stuck in limbo. He submits an application to the torture commission, and they tell him, we don't condone the fact that your witnesses were tortured, but you weren't tortured. Yeah.
Right.
So it was outside of the jurisdiction.
Case, right.
Yes, right. You weren't tortured in this case. You were tortured in the other case, the 1991 case, but we can't help you, right? So then, you know, I got involved when I saw the documentary, and of course, you know, I knew Jared is, you know, licensed in Illinois, and we kind of formed like Voltron. And, you know, and literally, let me just tell you something. Very few cases that I have, Jared knows this, I've got cases where men are getting ready to be exonerated 4 or 5 years the investigation takes, right? Marcus's investigator hits the ground in August, motions filed in January. We've got 7 affidavits from 2020. right? All the witnesses have recanted. Full file from the prosecutor's office where, you know, you see that Fred Bumke is the supervisor at the scene of the investigation. This is a guy that Marcus sued personally in 1993. He's the supervisor. He's the quarterback. He chooses what detectives are going to interview, what witnesses. He chooses Kenneth Boudreau to interview Kelly Stokes.
Right.
And then what we learn from Marcus Wiggins is that James O'Brien was in the police station after they arrest Marcus Wiggins 3 hours after the homicide, sticks his head and says, go suck your thumb in the corner now. Because allegedly after he was 13 and he had this, the trauma that he suffered when he was 13 from being electrocuted caused him to suck his thumb. O'Brien walks right in there and Marcus knows O'Brien because he was beat over the head with a flashlight by James O'Brien. And he tells him, we're going to stick your ass with this one. You ain't beating this one, right? The misconduct was so bad in the police station that Cedric Farley, one of the witnesses, said that they were passing around a single photo of Marcus. They showed him a single photo of Marcus. And they're talking about the lawsuit in the police station. But it gets worse. I mean, again, the first witness to mention Marcus's name is Terrence Tyler. And we go back to the Tyler name. Terrence is Sean Tyler's brother. Terrence is recovering right now from a stroke, but he recanted to two separate people. He recanted his statement and he said, I know Marcus is innocent, that he didn't commit this crime. I mean, this is unbelievable too, because Marcus has a co-defendant in this case.
Mm-hmm.
This co-defendant goes bench. He goes bench trial. Oh, let me just explain it. You have a right in America to a jury trial, mm-hmm. right? Would you want one person judging you or would you want 12 people judging you, right?
Yeah.
You want 12.
Exactly.
You definitely don't want a judge if you're a defendant. The co-defendant in Marcus's case goes bench and gets acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's crazy.
Okay. And he's still so scared to talk. Because of retaliation. Every witness that's recanted, Kelly Stokes recanted, fearful of retaliation. Yeah. Cedric Farley recanted, fearful of retaliation. Lavelle Adams, who was the co-defendant, refuses to talk because he said his lawyer said, don't speak because the Chicago Police Department will come after you.
Yeah. We're talking about folks, impoverished areas.
No protection.
No protection. There's no, I'm just going to get up and move. That's not an option.
Yeah.
Jason, there's
where
no,
you going?
Where the money at? You know, it's not an option. Just hostage in their own place.
And where's WITSEC for the civilians in Chicago?
Right.
Right. Where's witness protection against the police?
In case anyone thought we were exaggerating any part of the torture as a practice of the Chicago Police Department, a not insignificant number of police officers in the Chicago PD who were doing this systematically. There was an investigation which resulted in Burge himself going to prison for 3 years, which don't even get
three
me started.
Years, huh?
3 years for framing and torturing hundreds of people.
While he collected his pension.
Yeah. Collected.
Yeah.
His pension.
Right. Your tax dollars are paying for the shit. So there were actual convictions. This was all supported and all found, you know, and it's hard to prove these things. It's always hard to get any sort of justice when it's a person in blue that's committing
20, almost 30 years later.
Yeah. And I want to be real clear about this because this was a 30-year conspiracy because it starts in 91, right?
Yeah.
But Marcus has testified in other cases. Right, credibly,
yeah.
Where he's identified these officers because being around these men for so long, he was able to identify them and courts have found him credible. I mean, this is something that is firmly established and it's unfortunate that Marcus had to languish in prison for 23 years.
And then for me to survive that, come home from the jails, back into society where everybody want to play politics. Nobody want to step up and do the right thing, which is what you was put in these positions for anyway, is to do the right thing.
Yeah, and I think State's Attorney Kim Fox is the kind of person that will do the right thing. You know, we had her on Righteous Convictions just a few months ago. We asked her about your case, and although she couldn't comment on the ongoing proceedings, she expressed her hopes for getting to the truth and righting the wrongs of the past. I believe we've laid out plainly here today the only thing that justice could or even should mean here. And now, with your leave application granted, the ball is in her court.
if the Cook County State's Attorney's Office is not willing right now to say Marcus Wiggins is actually innocent, like me and Justin, and forget me and Justin, just look at the evidence says. If they aren't willing to do that, then Jason, what's wrong with being able to admit that this man didn't receive a fair trial?
Well, don't ask me, because obviously nothing. But Marcus, October 30th, 2020, you walked out of prison. You were paroled. You should have been exonerated. You will be exonerated. October 30th, you walked out of prison. What was that like?
Hey, it's like a feeling that I can't describe, man. But I was so happy. I was humble. I was peaceful. It was just felt so good, man, to actually have your feet hit the pavement and walk around and just feel that freedom, feel that wind, feel that space. It was amazing, man.
And we know you passed your driving test. Obviously, you had to get a cell phone, computer. I know you love FaceTime because we've spoken on FaceTime a bunch of times.
Yeah.
And all this new stuff that happened while you were locked up, right? How is it? Yeah. Are you getting used to it? Are you starting to feel comfortable with some of this new technology and stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm still learning how to work my phone, my laptop. I'm still having to learn that too. That's a lot of new stuff going on out here. I'm trying to get familiar with it.
And we're going to put links in the bio to learn more about Marcus's case, to be able to support him. And now we turn to the part of our show, which I call closing arguments. First of all, I thank each of you for being here. And then turn off my mic, kick back in my chair, and just sit and listen and learn from whatever you want to share, anything we might have left out, or anything you want to say at all about anything. I don't care if you want to talk about the weather. So let's do this. Alphabetical order is good for me, and also saves Marcus for the closing of the closing argument.
Yeah.
So you're batting cleanup, Marcus. Let's go to Jarrett first, then Justin, and then Marcus.
Look, justice requires us to stop waiting for things to become a hashtag before we stand up and do something. You know, as we think about the 1 year anniversary of us watching George Floyd lose his life, you know, we as a society have to say to ourselves, we've come a long way, but there's so much work to do. And I want to close my comments by saying this. There is power in people's voices. You know, people become jurors, people become judges, people are voters, people can make a difference. And I want people to think about this. When they are faced with things that challenge them doing the right thing and speaking up. If your life was to be depicted in a book where the only reader would be someone that means the world to you, would they read that book and walk away impressed right now about you standing up for what is right, calling out things that are wrong? If you can't answer that question definitively, there's more work to do. Jason, I can't answer that question definitively, so I get up and I work every day. And so I'm just calling on folks to not allow the norms and the depictions and narratives of folks to ever stop their moral compass from doing the right thing. I want to thank you, my friend, for having me on the show. Justin, Marcus, it's an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to know you, to represent you, and your mom, a real G. I'm going to get her name on a T-shirt real soon so people know who she is, because she is the one who should get the credit for giving birth to you more than once. She gave birth to you to get here, and she also loved you out of that situation. And she's still fighting. Justin will tell you, you okay? She'll put you in your place if you say something wrong, okay? So I thank you guys, man, again for this opportunity, and it's always a pleasure to be around you all.
I appreciate you too.
Justin?
Definitely Carolyn Johnson is a strong woman. I've spoken to her many, many, many times. So would you want somebody that you sued to investigate you for a homicide, successfully sued? I mean, I think that's like, I think this is a common sense case just to get the man a new trial. We don't even need to get to the witnesses. We could just stop it. Would you want somebody that you sued to be the person that investigated you for a homicide? The answer is no. Okay? I mean, and these guys really, really disliked Marcus. Not only does he sue them, but he also basically internally gets them in trouble, blows the lid off of Burge. This is like the keystone case that sets everything in motion. This is like the clearest case I've ever seen of retaliation. And that's before we get to the witnesses. All right. Every witness in this case is recanted. There's no evidence that Marcus was in a gang. There's no evidence that there was a car accident. There's no evidence that there were shell casings at the scene. There's no evidence that backs up anything. This trial literally like happened in a vacuum, right? Where everything was literally stripped away in this trial. So you don't hear the truth. It is just clearly a depiction that only the state's attorney and the police department wanted the jury to hear. And then Marcus had no defense. How can anyone have a fair trial when something like that goes on? And then when you come back and witnesses are a little bit more willing to talk about what actually happens, because it takes time for people to come. It takes time. And, you know, I'm not the same as I was when I was a teenager. There are things when I was a teenager that I probably would have lied about if I had gotten put into a certain situation. So it took time for this body of evidence to come forward and these witnesses to come out and tell you what happened in that precinct. These cops were obsessed with Marcus Wiggins, and we'll name them. James O'Brien, scumbag, okay? Kenneth Boudreaux, scumbag. And Fred Bunky, scumbag. They were all under the umbrella of John Burge. These are the ones that focused on Marcus, and every single witness that testified in this case said the same thing, which is, I was either beaten, I was threatened, and this is why I did what I did. And it's believable because it's happened. At this point, we don't have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hands. We got, I don't know. There's so many hands that you'd have to count the fingers that this has happened. It's just, it's unbelievable. And Marcus' case is clear. There was no case against Marcus. This is a complete, utter fabrication. And it's the clearest case I've ever seen of retaliation in my life.
All right, Marcus, saving the best for last. Over to you.
Well, we know and we see what's going on all around the country as far as dealing with the police, how they fabricate the police reports. And then all of a sudden, a video comes out opposite from what they filed in the report. So we know what's going on around the city. We know what's going on with these officers, especially in the city of Chicago, where I feel like I'm up against a giant. And don't nobody want to do the right thing because they friends, their careers, they worry about more convictions, more this, instead of doing the right thing. It frustrates me so much. It just frustrates me so much. But on a brighter note, y'all have been a blessing to me, man, since I've been out, man. Y'all truly been a blessing. All y'all. You know what I'm saying? All three of y'all. You know, I just want to continue to strive for what I'm doing. And I feel like I'm in debt to help the next person. I feel like I'm in debt to y'all to help the next person. To be on the same page that y'all on when y'all come out, help people, and fight the powers that be, man. And y'all definitely been a blessing, man. I definitely appreciate y'all from the bottom of my heart, man. And I'm just hoping Kim Fox do the right thing. She have full knowledge of what's going on in our community. She have full knowledge of what's going on with John Burge and the Midnight Crew. I just hope everybody do the right thing.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Please support your local innocence projects and go to the link in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis. The music on the show, as always, is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.